are no acts more dishonorable than harming infidels of one stripe or another for disrespecting a flag, a cross, a holy text. By asking for an accounting of the pros and cons of religion, I risk getting poked in the nose or worse, and yet I persist. Why? Because I believe that it is very important to break this spell and get us all to look carefully at the question with which I began this section. Are people right that the best way to live a good life is through religion? William James confronted the same problem squarely when he gave the Gifford lectures that became his great book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and I will echo his plea for forbearance. I am no lover of disorder and doubt as such. Rather do I fear to lose truth by this pretension to possess it already wholly. That we can gain more and more of it by moving always in the right direction, I believe as much as anyone. And I hope to bring you all to my way of thinking before the termination of these lectures. Till then do not, I pray you, harden your minds irrevocably against the empiricism which I profess. 1902, page 334. 2. The academic smokescreen. The word God refers to a depth and wholeness unlike anything that we humans know or can know. Certainly it is beyond our ability to discriminate and label. James B. Ashbrook and Carol Rausch Albright, The Humanizing Brain. A mystery is a mystery. If, on the other hand, we consider that it is important to study how people communicate about the idea of something being a mystery, there is no a priori reason why this should be beyond the reach of scientific method. Ilkka Pissiäinen, How Religion Works. To oppose the torrent of scholastic religion by such feeble maxims as these that it is impossible for the same thing to be and not to be, that the whole is greater than a part, that two and three make five, is pretending to stop the ocean with a bulrush. Will you set up profane reason against sacred mystery? No punishment is great enough for your impiety. And the same fires which were kindled for heretics will serve also for the destruction of philosophers. David Hume, The Natural History of Religion. James was trying to forestall dismissal by the devout, but they are not the only ones who resort to protectionism. A subtler, less forthright, but equally frustrating barrier to straightforward inquiry into the nature of religion has been erected and maintained by the scholarly friends of religion, many of whom are atheistic or agnostic connoisseurs, not champions of any creed. They do want to study religion, but only their way, not the way I am proposing, which by their lights is scientistic, reductionistic, and, of course, Philistine. I alluded to this opposition in Chapter 2 when I discussed the legendary gap that many want to see between the natural sciences and the interpretive sciences. Naturwissenschaften and Geisteswissenschaften. Anyone who tries to bring an evolutionary perspective to bear on any item of human culture, not just religion, can expect rebuffs ranging from howls of outrage to haughty dismissal from the literary, historical, and cultural experts in the humanities and social sciences. When the cultural phenomenon is religion, the most popular move is preemptive disqualification, and it has been well known since the 18th century, when it was used to discredit the earliest atheists and deists, such as David Hume and Baron D'Holbach, and some great American heroes, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine. Here is an early 20th century version from Emil Durkheim. He who does not bring to the study of religion a sort of religious sentiment cannot speak about it. He is like a blind man trying to talk about color. 1915, page 17. And here, half a century later, is an oft-quoted version from the great religious scholar Mircea Eliade. A religious phenomenon will only be recognized as such if it is grasped at its own level. That is to say, if it is studied as something religious. To try to grasp the essence of such a phenomenon by means of physiology, psychology, sociology, economics, linguistics, art, or any other study is false. It misses the one unique and irreducible element in it, the element of the sacred. 1963, page 3. You can find similar claims of preemptive disqualification protecting other topics. Only women are qualified to do research on women, according to some radical feminists, because only they can overcome the phallocentrism that renders males obtuse and biased in ways they can never acknowledge and counteract. Some multiculturalists insist that Europeans, including Americans, can never really cancel out their disabling Eurocentrism and understand the subjectivity of third world people. It takes one to know one, according to this theme in all its variations. Well, then, should we all just hunker down in our isolationist enclaves and wait for death to overtake us, since we can never understand one another? And then there is the brand of defeatism in my own home discipline, philosophy of mind, the Mysterian doctrine that insists that the human brain is simply not up to the task of understanding the human brain, that consciousness is not a puzzle but an insoluble mystery, so stop trying to explain it. What is transparent in all these claims is that they are not so much defeatist as protectionist. Don't even try because we're afraid you might succeed. You'll never understand Indian street magic if you're not an Indian born into the caste of magicians. It is impossible. But, of course, it is possible. Siegel, 1991. You'll never understand music unless you are born with a great ear for music and perfect pitch. Nonsense. In fact, people who have difficulty training themselves as musicians sometimes grind out insights into the nature of the music and how to perform it that were unavailable to those who glide effortlessly to musical mastery. Similarly, Temple Grandin, 1996, who is autistic and hence has a tin ear for the intentional stance and folk psychology, has come up with striking observations about how people present themselves and interact. Insights that had escaped the rest of us normal folk. We would never let business tycoons get away with saying that since we weren't plutocrats ourselves, we couldn't hope to understand the world of high finance, and were hence disqualified from investigating their deals. Generals can't escape civilian oversight by claiming that only those in uniform can appreciate what they are doing. And doctors have had to open up their methods and practices to the scrutiny of experts who are not themselves MDs. It would be dereliction of duty for us to let pedophiles insist that only those who appreciate a commitment to pedophilia can really understand them at all. So what we may say to those who insist that only those who believe, only those with a deep appreciation of the sacred, are to be entrusted with the investigation of religious phenomena, is that they are simply wrong about both facts and principles. They are mistaken about the imaginative and investigative powers of those they would exclude. And they are wrong to suppose that it might be justifiable on any grounds to limit the investigation of religion to those who are religious. If we say this politely, firmly, and often, they may eventually stop playing this card and let us get on with our investigations, hampered though we may be by our lack of faith. We'll just have to work harder. A related smokescreen is the more general declaration that the methods of the natural sciences cannot possibly make progress on human culture, which requires semiotics or hermeneutics, not experiments. A favorite exponent of this position is the anthropologist Clifford Geertz, who has put it this way. Believing, with Max Weber, that man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun, I take culture to be those webs, and the analysis of it to be, therefore, not an experimental science in search of law, but an interpretive one in search of meaning. 1973, page 5. Therefore? Back in 1973, it might have passed muster, but this argument is way out of date. That we human beings spin webs of significance is not in doubt. But those webs can be analyzed by methods that critically involve experiments and the disciplined methods of the natural sciences. Interpretation in the natural sciences is not opposed to experiment, and science isn't all subsumption under some covering law. All of cognitive science and all of evolutionary biology, for instance, is interpretive in ways that closely parallel some of the interpretive strategies of the humanities and anthropology. Dennett, 1983, 1995b. In fact, one of the few serious differences between the natural sciences and the humanities is that all too many thinkers in the humanities have decided that the postmodernists are right. It's all just stories, and all truth is relative. A cultural anthropologist who will go unnamed recently announced to his students that one of the great things about his field is that, given the same set of data, no two anthropologists would arrive at the same interpretation. End of story. Scientists often have just such disagreements about how to interpret a shared pool of unchallenged data, but for them it is the beginning of a task of resolution. Which of them is wrong? Experiments and further statistical analyses and the like are then designed to answer the question by discovering the truth. Not the capital T truth about everything, but just the ho-hum truth about this particular little factual disagreement. It is this subsequent process, which may take years, that has been declared impossible or unnecessary by these ideologues, who scoff at the very idea that there are objective truths about such matters to be discovered. They couldn't claim to prove that there is no such thing as objective truth, of course, for that would be to contradict themselves blatantly, and they have at least that much respect for logic. So they content themselves with clucking at the presumption and naivete of anyone who still believes in truth. It is hard to convey how boring this relentless barrage of defensive sneering is, so it is not surprising that some investigators have stopped trying to rebut it, and settle for poking fun at it instead. For example, right now I am typing on my keyboard with the intention of creating a coherent story about the logic of postmodernism. Were someone to study me, they might look beyond that surface-level intention I just offered and infer instead that what I really am doing is inventing a story from my personal experiences for the purpose of advancing my academic career. To accomplish this, they might argue, I am constructing a discourse that sets me apart from other people and thus increases my value as a writer. The more I confuse you, the smarter I appear. Why do I do this? Because I am a self-interested, white, heterosexual, privileged Protestant male who uses knowledge for power. A strategy not of savvy, but of manipulation and exploitation. For postmodernists, that which gets presented as truth, e.g. this book, is an invention, just a take on reality that masks what I am really doing, tricking everyone in order to acquire and maintain power. Sloan, 2004, pages 39 and 40. The pioneers whose scientific work on religion I have been introducing, Atrin, Boyer, Diamond, Dunbar, Lawson, Macaulay, McLennan, Sperber, Wilson, and the rest, all have to deal with this. It can be amusing in the end to see how they all brace themselves against this onslaught and, following in William James's footsteps, beg for an open-minded audience. So much pleading. The irony is that these intrepid interlopers have been far more conscientious in their attempts to get a sympathetic, informed view of religion than the self-appointed defenders of religion have been in trying to understand the point of view and methods of those they are resisting. When the humanist defenders have studied evolutionary biology and cognitive neuroscience and statistics and the rest with the same energy and imagination that the scientists have devoted to studying the histories, rites, and creeds of the various religions, they will become worthy critics of the work they fear. When the Zurich classicist Walter Burkert dared to expose his fellow humanists to biological thinking about the origins of religion in his Gifford Lectures of 1989, he became really the first humanist to attempt to cross the chasm going in the other direction. Burkert is a distinguished historian of ancient religion, widely read in anthropology, linguistics, and sociology, and he has begun educating himself in the evolutionary biology that he sees clearly must ground his own efforts at theorizing. One of the delights of reading his book, Creation of the Sacred, Tracts of Biology and Early Religions, 1996, is seeing how valuable his treasure trove of historical insights turns out to be when placed in the context of biological questions. And one of the causes for dismay is seeing how gingerly he thinks he must tiptoe around the hair-trigger sensitivities of his fellow humanists when he introduces these dread biological notions into their world. Dennett, 1997, 1998b. Scientists have much to learn from the historians and the cultural anthropologists. The infrastructure for constructive collaborations already exists in the form of interdisciplinary journals, such as Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion and Method and Theory in the Study of Religion, and Journal of Cognition and Culture, as well as professional societies and websites. One of my goals in this book is to make it easier for subsequent researchers to enter these forbidden zones and find friendly natives with whom to collaborate, without having to hack their way through a jungle of hostile defenders. They will discover that the anthropologists and historians have already thought of most of their new ideas and have plenty to say about what the problems with them are. So I recommend that they behave modestly, ask lots of questions, and just ignore the often breathtakingly rude and condescending put-downs they inspire in those who dread their approach. 3. Why does it matter what you believe? Today we have to change our attitude from that of description to that of appreciation. We have to ask whether the fruits in question can help us to judge the absolute value of what religion adds to human life. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Thomas Nagel, The Last Word. We have one last deflector to set aside before we can safely address the main question. Why believe in belief in God? Many people would answer, simply because God exists. They believe in trees and mountains, tables and chairs, people and places, wind and water, and God. This would indeed explain their belief in God, but not the fact that they take believing in God to be so important. In particular, why do people care so much what other people believe about God? I believe that the center of the earth consists mainly of molten iron and nickel. Relative to other things, I believe this is a pretty big and exciting fact. Just imagine there's a ball of molten iron and nickel nearby. It's about the size of the moon, and a lot closer. In fact, it's between me and Australia. Lots of people don't know this, and too bad for them, since it's quite a delightful fact. But it really doesn't bother me that they don't share my belief or my delight. Why should it matter so much whether others share your belief in God? Does God care? I can see that Jehovah might be really peeved if he found lots of people oblivious to his power and greatness. Part of what makes Jehovah such a fascinating participant in stories of the Old Testament is his king-like jealousy and pride and his great appetite for praise and sacrifices. But we have moved beyond this God, haven't we? The creative intelligence that is supposed by many to have done all the design work we evolutionists attribute to natural selection is not the sort of being that could be jealous, is it? I know professors who can get mighty annoyed if you pretend you haven't heard of their published work, but it is hard to see why the creative intelligence that invented DNA and the metabolic cycle and mangrove trees and sperm whales would care whether any of its creatures recognized its authorship. The second law of thermodynamics can't care whether anybody believes in it, and I would think that the ground of all being must be a similarly unmoved mover. An anthropologist once told me about an African tribe, I can't remember their name, whose dealings with their neighbors proceeded at a stately pace. An emissary sent by foot to the settlement of a neighboring tribe would rest for a day after his arrival before conducting any official business, since he had to wait for his soul to catch up. Souls in that culture are slow walkers, apparently. We can see a similar time lag in the migration many believers have made from a highly anthropomorphic God to a more abstract and hard-to-imagine God. They still use anthropomorphic language when speaking of a God who, sick, is not a supernatural being at all, but just an essence. To use Stark's useful, if philosophically misbegotten, terminology. It is obvious enough why they do this. It permits them to carry over all the connotations required to make any sense of a personal love of God. One can feel, I suppose, a certain affection or gratitude for a law of nature. Good old gravity, she just never lets you down. But the proper object of adoration really has to be some sort of person, however inconceivably unlike us talking, featherless bipeds. Only a person could be literally disappointed in you if you misbehaved, or could answer your prayers, or forgive you. So the theological incorrectness that persists in imagining God to be a wise old guy in the sky is not only tolerated by the experts, but subtly encouraged. William James opined at the turn of the 20th century, "Today a deity who should require bleeding sacrifices to placate him would be too sanguinary to be taken seriously," 1902, page 328. But a century later, few would agree publicly with Thomas Nagel when he candidly says that he would not want such a god to exist. I doubt if Nagel finds Spinoza's Deus sive natura, God or nature, repugnant, and he may well be as indifferent as I am to the ground of all being, whatever that is. If pressed, many people insist that the anthropomorphic language used to describe God is metaphorical, not literal. One might suppose, then, that the curious adjective God-fearing would have faded into disuse over the years, a fossil trace of a rather embarrassingly juvenile period in our religious past. But far from it. People want a God who can be loved and feared the way you love or fear another person. Religion, in short, is a monumental chapter in the history of human egotism. The gods believed in, whether by crude savages or by men disciplined intellectually, agree with each other in recognizing personal calls, James observed. Today, quite as much as at any previous age, the religious individual tells you that the divine meets him on the basis of his personal concerns, 1902, page 491. For many believers, of course, this is all just obvious. God is, of course, a person who talks to them directly. If not on a daily basis, then at least in a once-in-a-lifetime revelation. But as James pointed out, the believers themselves shouldn't put too much stock in such experiences. The supernormal incidents, such as voices and visions and overpowering impressions of the meaning of suddenly presented scripture texts, the melting emotions and tumultuous affections connected with the crisis of change, may all come by way of nature, or worse still, be counterfeited by Satan, 1902, page 238. So, however convinced some people may be by their powerful personal experiences, such revelations don't travel well. They can't be used as contributions to the communal discussion that we are now conducting. Philosophers and theologians have often debated the question of whether acts are good because God loves them, or God loves them because they are good. And although these inquiries may make some sense within a theological tradition, in any ecumenical setting where we aspire for universal consensus, we have to choose the latter presumption. Moreover, the evidence of history makes it clear that, as time has passed, people's moral sense about what is permissible and what is heinous has shifted. And along with it, their convictions about what God loves and hates. Those who see either blasphemy or adultery as a crime, deserving the death penalty, are today a dwindling minority, thank heaven. Still, the reason people care so much what other people believe about God is a fine reason so far as it goes. They want the world to be a better place. They think that getting others to share their beliefs about God is the best way to achieve that end, and this is far from obvious. I too want the world to be a better place. This is my reason for wanting people to understand and accept evolutionary theory. I believe that their salvation may depend on it. How so? By opening their eyes to the dangers of pandemics, degradation of the environment, and loss of biodiversity, and by informing them about some of the foibles of human nature. So isn't my belief that belief in evolution is the path to salvation a religion? No, there is a major difference. We who love evolution do not honor those whose love of evolution prevents them from thinking clearly and rationally about it. On the contrary, we are particularly critical of those whose misunderstandings and romantic misstatements of these great ideas mislead themselves and others. In our view, there is no safe haven for mystery or incomprehensibility. Yes, there is humility and awe and sheer delight at the glory of the evolutionary landscape. But it is not accompanied by, or in the service of, a willing, let alone thrilling, abandonment of reason. So I feel a moral imperative to spread the word of evolution, but evolution is not my religion. I don't have a religion. So now, with apologies to those whose equanimity is disturbed by my asking such a fundamental question, what are the pros and cons of religion? Is it worthy of the intense loyalty it has inspired in most of the people of the world? William James led the way in this inquiry as well, and I will use his words to frame the issues for us, because they are wonderful in themselves, but also because they reveal some of the progress we have made in the last century, clarifying and sharpening our thinking in a number of regards. Long before anybody talked of memes or memetics, James noted that religions had indeed evolved in spite of all their claims to eternal and immutable principles, and he noted that this evolution had always been responsive to human value judgments. What I then propose to do is, briefly stated, to test saintliness by common sense, to use human standards to help us decide how far the religious life commends itself as an ideal kind of human activity. It is but the elimination of the humanly unfit, and the survival of the humanly fittest, applied to religious beliefs. And if we look at history candidly and without prejudice, we have to admit that no religion has ever in the long run established or proved itself in any other way. 1902, page 331. When James speaks of what is humanly unfit, he means something like unfit for human use rather than biologically or genetically unfit, and this choice of words blurs his vision. In spite of his desire to look at history without prejudice, his phrase biases his judgment in the direction of optimism. The memes that have resisted extinction over the centuries are only those memes that actually somehow enhance humanity. What do they enhance exactly? Human genetic fitness, human happiness, human well-being. James gives us a very Victorian version of Darwinism. What survives must be good, because evolution is always a matter of progress toward the better. Does evolution foster the good? It all depends, as we have seen, on how we ask and answer the cui bono question. But now, for the first time in the book, we are stepping aside from explanation and description and turning to appreciation, as James said, asking what ought to be, not just what is, and how it got that way. If the fruits for life of the state of conversion are good, we ought to idealize and venerate it, even though it be a piece of natural psychology. If not, we ought to make short work of it, no matter what supernatural being may have infused it. 1902, page 237. Does religion make us better? James distinguished two main ways in which this might be true. It might make people more effective in their daily lives, healthier both physically and mentally, more steadfast and composed, more strong-willed against temptation, less tormented by despair, better able to bear their misfortunes without giving up. He calls this the mind-cure movement. Or it might make people morally better. The ways in which religion purports to accomplish this he calls saintliness. Or it could accomplish both ends in varying degrees under different circumstances. There is a lot to be said regarding both of them, and the rest of this chapter will be devoted to the first claim, leaving the hugely important question of the role of religion in morality to another chapter. 4. What can your religion do for you? Religion in the shape of mind cure gives to some of us serenity, moral poise, and happiness, and prevents certain forms of disease as well as science does, or even better in a certain class of persons. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. No one dares suggest that neon signs blinking the message that Jesus saves may be false advertising. R. Lawrence Moore, Selling God. Pray. To ask that the laws of the universe be annulled in behalf of a single petitioner confessedly unworthy. Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary. In a dangerous world, there will always be more people around whose prayers for their own safety have been answered than those whose prayers have not. Nicholas Humphrey's Law of the Efficacy of Prayer, 2004. James speculated that there may be two entirely different types of people, the healthy-minded and the sick-minded, who need different things from religion, and noted that churches face an everlasting inner struggle of the acute religion of the few against the chronic religion of the many, page 114. You can't please everybody all the time, so every religion must make its compromises. His informal surveys and inquiries were the forerunners of the intensive and sometimes quite sophisticated market research undertaken by religious leaders in recent years, as well as the more academic investigations conducted by psychologists and other social scientists trying to assess the claims made on behalf of religion. Religious revival movements flourished in James's day, but so did secular promoters of all manner of fantastical products and regimens. The self-help infomercials on television today are the descendants of a long line of earlier hucksters who plied their wares in tent shows and rented theaters. One hears of the gospel of relaxation, of the don't worry movement, of people who repeat to themselves youth, health, vigor when dressing in the morning as their motto for the day, page 95. James asked if the religions provided bracing as good as or better than that of their secular counterparts, and observed that whatever they may protest about their aloofness from science, in fact, religions do rely on experiment and verification at every turn. Live as if I were true, religion says, and every day will practically prove you right, page 119. In other words, you'll see the results for yourself. Try it. You'll like it. Here, in the very heyday of science's authority, it carries on an aggressive warfare against the scientific philosophy, and succeeds by using science's own peculiar methods and weapons, page 120. The best salespeople are satisfied customers, and even if that is not the point of being a member of a church, there is nothing wrong with paying close attention to any factors that may improve the health, both spiritual and physical, of those who are loyal and active members. If I were to try to design a secular organization for furthering world peace, for instance, I would certainly keep my eyes open for any features that would have the incidental benefit of boosting members' health or prosperity, since I recognize that the organization would always be competing against all the other ways people can spend their time and energy. Even if I expect and encourage sacrifices from those who join, I should weigh the sacrifices carefully and eliminate any gratuitous shortcomings and replace them with benefits if possible, so as to give greater leverage to the essential sacrifices. So is religion good for your health? There is growing evidence that many religions have succeeded remarkably well on this score, improving both the health and the morale of their members, quite independently of the good works they may have accomplished to benefit others. For instance, eating disorders such as anorexia nervosa and bulimia are much less common among women in Muslim countries, in which the physical attractiveness of women plays a muted role relative to that in westernized countries. Abid, 1998. A current surge of interest is bringing to bear all the statistical tools of epidemiology and public health on such questions as whether regular churchgoers live longer, are less likely to have heart attacks, and so forth. And in most of the surveys, the results are positive, often strongly so. For an extensive overview, now rapidly becoming out of date, see Koenig et al., 2000. The early results are impressive enough to have provoked knee-jerk skeptical dismissals from some atheists who haven't stopped to consider how independent these questions are from whether or not any religious beliefs are true. We already know from studies involving many different kinds of performance that if you randomly tell half a group of subjects that they are above average on the task in question, they will do better. So the power of false belief to improve human capacities is already established. There are studies that demonstrate, according to some, e.g. Taylor and Brown, 1988, that positive illusions improve mental health. But there are critics who say the case is not yet secure. Coleman and Block, 1994. It might well be that believing in God and engaging in all the practices that go with that belief improves your state of mind and thereby improves your health by, say, 10%. We should do the research to find out for sure, bearing in mind that it also may be true that believing that Earth is being invaded by space aliens who plan to take us to their planet and teach us all how to fly, and engaging in all the behaviors that are appropriate to that belief, improves your state of mind and health by 20%. We won't know until we run the experiments. But since the world's literature is overflowing with stories of people who have benefited greatly from being deceived by well-wishing acquaintances, we shouldn't be surprised to find positive effects for well-chosen falsehoods. And if such concoctions were more effective than any known religious creed, we would have to confront the ethical question of whether any amount of health benefits could justify such deliberate misrepresentation. The results so far are strong, but in need of further investigation, since the benign effects that religions do seem to be having would probably diminish if skepticism took hold, regardless of whether it was justified, caution is called for. Many effects studied by psychologists depend on naive subjects who are relatively uninformed about the mechanisms and conditions of the phenomena. The effects are diminished or entirely obliterated when subjects are given more information. We should be alert to the possibility that the good effects, if they hold up to further scrutiny, might be jeopardized by anything that throws too strong a light of public scrutiny on them. On the other hand, the effects may be robust under a barrage of skeptical attention. We will just have to see. And, of course, if the results tend to evaporate as we study them more intensively, we can anticipate that those who are sure that the effects are real will protest that the climate of skepticism is inimical to the effects, making perfectly real phenomena vanish under the harsh light of science. And they may be right, and they may be wrong. This, too, is indirectly testable. Here, more than in any other area of conflict between science and religion, those who are dubious about or fearful of the authority of science will have to search their souls. Do they acknowledge the power of science, properly conducted, to settle such controversial factual questions? Or do they reserve judgment, waiting to see what the verdict will be? If it turns out that, in spite of the anecdotal evidence and mountains of testimonials, religion is no better than alternative sources of well-being, will they be willing to accept that result and drop the advertising? Some major pharmaceutical companies are currently under fire for trying to suppress the publication of studies they funded that fail to show the effectiveness of their products. In the future, it now seems clear, these companies will be obliged to consent in advance to the publication of all the research they fund, however it comes out. That is the ethos of science. The price you pay for the authoritative confirmation of your favorite hypothesis is risking an authoritative refutation of it. Those who want to make claims about the health benefits of religion will have to live by the same rules, prove it or drop it. And if you set out to prove it and fail, you are obliged to tell us. The potential benefits of joining the scientific community on these issues are enormous. Getting the authority of science in support of what you say you believe with all your heart and soul. Not for nothing have the new religions of the last century or two been given names like Christian Science and Scientology. Even the Roman Catholic Church, with its unfortunate legacy of persecution of its own scientists, has recently been eager to seek scientific confirmation and accept the risk of disconfirmation of its traditional claims about the Shroud of Turin, for example. One strand in the current wave of research on religion raises a much more fundamental issue in undeniable terms. Studies are now underway on the efficacy of intercessory prayer, praying with the real hope and real intent that God would step in and act for the good of some specific other persons or other entity. Longman, 2000. These are quite unlike the studies mentioned above in their import. As we have just noted, scientists have plenty of resources already well in hand that could explain general health benefits to those who pray and practice and tithe. No supernatural forces would need to be invoked to account for such ambient health benefits. But if a properly conducted, double-blind, rigorously controlled test with a sufficiently large population of subjects were to demonstrate that people who are prayed for are significantly more likely to get well than people who get the same medical treatments but are not prayed for, this would be all but impossible for science to account for without a major revolution. Many atheists and other skeptics are so confident that no such effects could possibly exist that they are eager to see these tests performed. Those, in contrast, who believe in the efficacy of intercessory prayer have a tough call here. The stakes are high since, if the studies are performed properly and show no positive effect, the religions that practice intercessory prayer would be obliged by the principles of truth in advertising to renounce all claims to its efficacy, just like the pharmaceutical companies. On the other hand, a positive result would stop science in its tracks. After 500 years of steady retreat in the face of advancing science, religion could demonstrate in terms that the scientists would have to respect that its claims to truth were not all vacuous. In October 2001, the New York Times reported a remarkable Columbia University study that purportedly showed that infertile women who were prayed for became pregnant twice as often as those who were not prayed for. Published in a major scientific journal, the Journal of Reproductive Medicine, the results were worth the headlines, since Columbia University is not a Bible Belt college that would be instantly under suspicion in many quarters. Its medical school, a bastion of the medical establishment, supported the results in a news release that described the safeguards that had been taken to ensure that this was a properly controlled investigation. But to make a long and sordid story short, it has subsequently turned out that this was a case of scientific fraud. Of the three authors of the study, two have now left their positions at Columbia University, and the third, Daniel Wirth, who had no connection with Columbia, has recently pled guilty in an unrelated case to conspiracy to commit mail fraud and conspiracy to commit bank fraud, and turns out not to have any medical credentials at all. Flam, 2004. One study is discredited, and others have been severely criticized, but there are still others underway, including a major study by Dr. Herbert Benson and his colleagues at Harvard Medical School, funded by the Templeton Foundation, so there is no verdict yet on the hypothesis that intercessory prayer actually works. See, e.g., Dusick et al., 2002. Even if studies eventually show that it doesn't, there will still be plenty of evidence of less miraculous benefits of being an active member of a church, which is all that many churches have ever maintained. The Reverend Raymond J. Lawrence, Jr., director of pastoral care at New York Presbyterian Hospital Columbia University Medical Center, expresses the liberal view. There's no way to put God to the test, and that's exactly what you're doing when you design a study to see if God answers your prayers. This whole exercise cheapens religion and promotes an infantile theology that God is out there ready to miraculously defy the laws of nature in answer to a prayer. Carey, 2004, page 32. Prolonged exposure to the fumes of incense and burning candles may have some detrimental health effect, concluded one recent study. Lung et al. I'm not kidding. 2003. But there is plenty of other evidence that active participation in religious organizations can improve the morale and hence the health of participants. Moreover, the defenders of religion can rightly point to less tangible but more substantial benefits to their adherents, such as having a meaning for their lives provided. People who are suffering, even if their morale is not improved in measurable ways, may well gain some solace from nothing more than the knowledge that they are being acknowledged, noticed, thought about. It would be a mistake to suppose that these spiritual blessings have no place in the inventory of reasons that we skeptics are trying to assay, just as it would be a mistake to suppose that the non-existence of an intercessory prayer effect would show that prayer is a useless practice. There are subtler benefits to be evaluated, but they do need to be identified. Chapter 9. Before we can ask the question of whether religion is, all things considered, a good thing, we must first work through several protective barriers, such as the love barrier, the academic territoriality barrier, and the loyalty to God barrier. Then we can calmly consider the pros and cons of religious allegiance, looking first at the question, is religion good for people? And the evidence to date on that question is mixed. It does seem to provide some health benefits, for instance, but it is too early to say whether there are other, better ways of delivering these benefits, and too early to say if the side effects outweigh the benefits. Chapter 10. The more important question, finally, is whether religion is the foundation of morality. Do we get the content of morality from religion, or is it an irreplaceable infrastructure for organizing moral action? Or does it provide moral or spiritual strength? Many think the answers are obvious and positive, but these are questions that need to be re-examined in the light of what we have learned. Chapter 10. Morality and Religion. 1. Does religion make us moral? Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, One thing thou lackest, go thy way, sell whatsoever thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come, take up the cross, and follow me. Mark chapter 10, verse 21. The Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence his soul hateth. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire, and brimstone, and an horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. Psalms chapter 11, verses 5 and 6. Believing as I do that man in the distant future will be a far more perfect creature than he now is, it is an intolerable thought that he and all other sentient beings are doomed to complete annihilation after such long-continued slow progress. To those who fully admit the immorality of the human soul, the destruction of our world will not appear so dreadful. Charles Darwin, Life and Letters. Non-Muslims love their life too much. They can't fight, and they are cowards. They don't understand that there will be life after death. You cannot live forever, you will die. Life after death is forever. If life after death were an ocean, the life you live is only a drop in the ocean. So it's very important that you live your life for Allah. So you are rewarded after death. A young Mujahideen from Pakistan, quoted by Jessica Stern, Terror in the Name of God. Good people will do good things and bad people will do bad things. But for good people to do bad things, that takes religion. Steven Weinberg, 1999. Religion plays its most important role in supporting morality, many think, by giving people an unbeatable reason to do good, the promise of an infinite reward in heaven, and, depending on tastes, the threat of an infinite punishment in hell if they don't. Without the divine carrot and stick goes this reasoning, people would loll about aimlessly or indulge their basest desires, break their promises, cheat on their spouses, neglect their duties, and so on. There are two well-known problems with this reasoning. One, it doesn't seem to be true, which is good news, since, two, it is such a demeaning view of human nature. I have uncovered no evidence to support the claim that people, religious or not, who don't believe in reward in heaven and or punishment in hell are more likely to kill, rape, rob, or break their promises than people who do. The prison population in the United States shows Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, and others, including those with no religious affiliation, represented about as they are in the general population. Brights and others with no religious affiliation exhibit the same range of moral excellence and turpitude as born-again Christians. But more to the point, so do members of religions that de-emphasize or actively deny any relationship between moral behavior on earth and eventual post-mortem reward and punishment. And when it comes to family values, the available evidence to date supports the hypothesis that brights have the lowest divorce rate in the United States, and born-again Christians the highest. Barna, 1999. Needless to say, these results strike so hard at the standard claims of greater moral virtue among the religious that there has been a considerable surge of further research initiated by religious organizations attempting to refute them. At this time, nothing very surprising has emerged, and nothing approaching a settled consensus among researchers has been achieved, but one thing we can be sure of is that if there is a significant positive relationship between moral behavior and religious affiliation, practice, or belief, it will soon be discovered, since so many religious organizations are eager to confirm their traditional beliefs about this scientifically. They are quite impressed with the truth-finding power of science when it supports what they already believe. Every month that passes without such a demonstration underlines the suspicion that it just isn't so. It is clear enough why believers might want to come up with evidence that belief in heaven and hell has benign effects. Everybody already knows the evidence for the countervailing hypothesis, that the belief in a reward in heaven can sometimes motivate acts of monstrous evil. Nevertheless, there are many in the religious community who would not welcome the demonstration that a belief in God's reward in heaven or punishment in hell makes a significant difference, since they view this as an infantile concept of God in the first place, pandering to immaturity instead of encouraging genuine moral commitment. As Mitchell Silver notes, the God who rewards goodness in heaven bears a striking resemblance to the hero of the popular song, "Santa Claus is Coming to Town." Like Santa, God knows if you are sleeping, he knows if you're awake, he knows if you've been bad or good. The lyrics continue, "So be good for goodness' sake." Catchy, but a logical solecism. In logic, the song should have continued, "So be good for the sake of the electronic equipment, dolls, sports gear, and other gifts you hope to get, but will get only if the omniscient and just Santa judges you worthy of receiving." If you were good for goodness' sake, the all-seeing Santa would be irrelevant as a motivator of your virtue. In press. Moral philosophers who have agreed about little else from the days of Hume and Kant through Nietzsche to the present have regarded this pie-in-the-sky vision of morality as something of a trap, a reductio ad absurdum, into which only the most unwary moralist would fall. Many religious thinkers agree. A doctrine that trades in a person's good intentions for the prudent desires of a rational maximizer shopping around for eternal bliss may win a few cheap victories, luring a few selfish and unimaginative souls into behaving themselves for a while, but at the cost of debasing their larger campaign for goodness. We see an echo of this familiar recognition in the derision heaped by many commentators on the Al-Qaeda hijackers of 9/11. For their purported goal of luxuriating in heaven with 72 virgins, each, as the reward for their martyrdom. We may shun this theme as a foundation of our morality today, yet still honor it for having played a founding role in the past as a ladder that, once climbed, may be discarded. How could this work? The economist Thomas Schelling has pointed out that belief in a deity who will reward goodness and punish evil transforms many situations from subjective to secured, at least in the believer's mind. Quoted in Nessa, ED, 2001, page 16. Consider a situation in which two parties confront each other with a prospect for cooperating on something both parties would want, but each is afraid the other will renege on any bargain struck, and there are no authorities or stronger parties around to enforce it. Promises can be made and then broken, but sometimes they can be secured. A commitment may be secured by being self-enforcing. For instance, you can burn your bridges behind you so you can't escape even if you change your mind. Or it may be secured by your greater desire to preserve your reputation. You may have good reason to fulfill your side of a contract, even if your reason for signing it in the first place has lapsed. Simply because your reputation is also at stake. A valuable social commodity indeed. Or, and this is Schelling's point, a promise made in the eyes of God may well convince those who believe in that God that a sort of virtual escrow account has been created, protecting both parties and giving each the confidence to move ahead without fear of reneging by the other party. Consider the current situation in Iraq, where a security force is supposed to provide a temporary scaffolding on which to construct a working society in post-Saddam Iraq. It might actually have worked from the outset if the force had been large enough and well enough trained and deployed to reassure people without having to fire a shot. With insufficient forces, the credibility of the peacekeepers was diminished, however, and a positive feedback cycle of violence was put in motion, destroying confidence in security. How can you break out of such a downward spiral? It is hard to say. The flawed and fragile democracy that has been installed may still overcome its corrupt and violence-ridden beginnings if the world is lucky, however forlorn it looks today. Failed states have a way of perpetuating themselves and perpetuating both the misery of their inhabitants and the insecurity of their neighbors. In the distant past, the very idea of an overseeing God might often have permitted an otherwise chaotic and ungovernable population to bootstrap itself into a working state, with enough law and order so that credible promising could take hold. Only in such a climate of trust can investment and commerce and free passage and all the other things we take for granted in a working society flourish. Such a meme would be vulnerable to collapse if its credibility was threatened, just as surely as the occupying forces in Iraq depend on their problematic credibility for their own effectiveness. The rationale for incorporating whatever doubt suppression devices could be found would have been obvious to the blind forces of cultural selection and probably to the authorities themselves. Today, when patterns of mutual trust are quite securely established in modern democratic states independently of any shared religious belief, the bristling defenses of religions against corrosive doubt begin to look vestigial, like fossil traces of an earlier epoch. We no longer need God the policeman to create a climate in which we can make promises and conduct human affairs on their basis, but he lives on in legal oaths, and in the imaginations of many who are terrified of the prospect of abandoning religion. But reward in heaven is not the only, and certainly not the best, inspirational theme in religious doctrine. The God who is watching you need not be seen to be either list-making Santa or Orwell's Big Brother, but instead a hero or role model, as we say today, someone to emulate rather than fear. If God is just and merciful and forgiving and loving and the most wonderful being imaginable, then anyone who loves God should want to be just and merciful and forgiving and loving, for goodness sake. Blurring these two very different views of God's motivating role into one is yet another casualty of the gauze curtains of soft-focused veneration through which we traditionally inspect religion. Still, there may be the best of free-floating reasons for not peering too closely at these fine differences between doctrines. Why create dissension where none need exist? Don't rock the boat. It is widely agreed that all religions provide social infrastructures for creating and maintaining moral teamwork. Perhaps their value as organizers and amplifiers of good intentions far outweighs any deficits created by the putative incoherence created by contradictions between some of their doctrines. Perhaps it would be foolish perfectionism and an act of moral ineptitude to distract ourselves with minor conflicts of dogma when there is so much work to be done making the world a better place. This is a persuasive claim, but it has the disadvantage of undercutting itself somewhat in public, since it amounts to making the acknowledgement that, good as we aren't perfect, but we have more important things to do than fix our foundations. A modest admission that jars with the traditional claims of purity that religions find irresistible. Moreover, any such lapses from absolutism threaten to undermine the chief psychological source of the very organizational power that is being recognized. Today's religious warriors may be too sophisticated to expect their God to stop the bullets in midair at their behest. But their belief in the absolute rightness of their cause may well be a crucial ingredient in creating the calm with which truly effective soldiers go into battle. As William James puts it, "Whoever not only says, but feels, God's will be done, is mailed, armored, against every weakness. and the whole historic array of martyrs, missionaries, and religious reformers is there to prove the tranquil-mindedness under naturally agitating or distressing circumstances which self-surrender brings. 1902, page 285. This heroic state of mind does not harmonize well with secular modesty, and though many think it is true that religious fanatics make the most reliable soldiers, we may well wonder whether, all things considered, James is right when he goes on to note, quoting a clear-headed Austrian officer, "Far better is it for an army to be too savage, too cruel, too barbarous, than to possess too much sentimentality and human reasonableness," page 366. Here is a morally relevant question well worth careful empirical investigation. Can a secular armed force, motivated in the main by a love of liberty or democracy, not of God or Allah, maintain its credibility, and hence its effectiveness with a minimum of bloodshed, against an army of fanatics? Until we know the answer, we risk being blackmailed by sheer fear into indoctrinating the troops with barbarism. It will take a combination of courage and wise planning, and maybe a large helping of luck, even to do the research needed to find out. But the alternative is even more grim. Perpetuating the fatal downward spiral of righteous wars, fought by misguided young people sent into dubious battle by leaders who don't really believe the myths that sustain those who are risking their lives. As the Grand Inquisitor says in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, "Beyond the grave they will find nothing but death. But we shall keep the secret, and for their happiness we shall allure them with the reward of heaven and eternity." There is a further allure for the zealot, and it is probably, who knows, a more robust motivator than the prospect of heavenly reward. The license to kill, to adapt Ian Fleming's all-too-appealing fantasy about the official status of James Bond. Some people, it seems, who knows, are just bloodthirsty or thrill-seeking, and as our customs become ever more civilized and opposed to violence, such people are highly motivated to find a cause that can provide them with a moral justification for their swashbuckling, whether it is liberating